Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Details in the Deal. My name is Matt Major from Growth Mode Content. I am really excited to be asked to come back and help kick off this second episode. The first episode was really awesome. And
thank you, Matt.
Welcome back, of course, the star of the show, Christine O'Connell Moore. Christine, you got some great feedback on that first one.
I did, and I'm so grateful to all of my friends and family and associates who commented on the posts and the podcast. And I even had one person who said, we need to do some business together. So that was very exciting.
That's it. You know, what we're trying to do here is really get your name out there and help build a brand. And that's typically a very long-term endeavor, but it's so cool to see an immediate response like that. And it's because you're so interesting and you know your business so much, right?
Thank you.
I mean, that's what we found making podcasts with so many people. People don't realize how much of an expert so many of our good friends are in various fields. And to get their knowledge and to share it is pretty cool. And today I'm kind of excited because, I'm not going to be doing all the talking. You've got a guest who's going to join us a little later in the program. And also we're going to talk about due diligence.
Yes.
What, not to get into it too deep just yet, but what even is due diligence?
So it's a very important part of the deal. It's what you typically do. You do it in phases, but typically you do initial due diligence when you look at a deal and you say, you know, I kind of like this, I'm going to make an offer. And then you'll have a due diligence period typically in your contract. And during that time, you'll do financial due diligence, you'll do environmental due diligence, you'll do title due diligence. And you want to make sure that what you've been told about the deal is actually what happens, what's happening.
All right. I'm pretty excited to dig into this.
Great.
But I don't want to do it just yet. We're gonna call it. It's gonna be a tease here. Because first, I really want to check in with you, and I want to know just what have you been up to since we last talked. What's going on with the business?
Thank you.
What have you been doing?
It's been very busy, which is exciting. I'm working on two apartment listings right now, and usually over the winter, it's a little quiet for apartment listings. And I've got a lot of buyers for apartments. So
wow.
Hopefully, by the next podcast, we'll be able to talk specifics about it.
When you say apartment, is this like a home that's got two units in it, or is it apartment building, or what?
These are buildings and complexes.
Wow.
Yes. So one is 42 units and one is 26 units.
Oh, that's no joke.
No joke. And in different parts of central and upstate New York.
That's a little different than renting out the in-law apartment in my backyard, right?
Without question, yes. And it's my niche, and it's what I've been doing for 50 years probably is working on apartments in one way or another.
Wow. Is it when you say it's your niche, what are there types of housing? Or is there types of, college housing versus retirement homes, things like that? Or is it really just multi-unit apartments are your expertise all over the place?
Different types. And they all have different needs, and they all have different types of buyers for them too, which is always interesting. Student housing buyers are student housing buyers typically. It's a 9 or 10 month lease perhaps, and then you spend all of July and August getting those apartments ready.
Wow.
People who like 100 units or more. That's what everybody looks for. Those are the unicorns. They're
wow.
really hard to find. And often generations own them, and especially downstate more than upstate. So that that's what I look for when I can try to find opportunities for my apartment clients. And then senior housing is terrific, and it's growing because of our aging demographics.
Sure.
So there's more and more of a need for affordable senior housing, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that happening in the marketplace.
Wow, that's incredible. If you could just a little bit, it seems you mentioned the 100 unit is the unicorn. Is it true to say that the more units in a property, the more profitable it would be, and obviously the more desirable?
Generally, yes, because you can spread your expenses out.
Gotcha.
You don't need to have more managers if you have 100 units versus 70 units.
Gotcha.
So people look to spread their expenses out. You can use maintenance people for multiple buildings and utilities. Normally, you may be able to get breaks on utilities because they're larger, and you can make deals. You can buy. You can if you think that utilities are on a lower end right now, you can buy them. You can buy them in advance.
Oh wow!
So there's lots of opportunities with scale.
Sure, that's very interesting. Do you find a lot of folks who are the buyers for those? Are they big companies that have done this since they started, or are they investors that kind of built their way up to a bigger property?
Well, usually people don't start with 100 units.
Yeah, right.
So they'll start with maybe two.
Okay.
Then the next one they buy is a 10 unit, and then it's a 20 unit, and then they build from there.
So you do see a lot of folks that kind of go through that progression. That's pretty neat. Yes. I just think that's, and especially for you, because, you know, as you mentioned in the last time, you've had businesses and properties that you've sold multiple times over.
Yes. And through generations too.
That's so cool. Talk to us a little bit about kind of what these private equity deals that happen in different things that you're seeing around and being involved in.
I'm seeing it more and more. Private equity is a phrase that in upstate New York you hardly ever heard 5, 6, 7 years ago, unless you were talking maybe venture money. But I would, last week I was talking to a woman who owns a business that would traditionally not be considered common for private equity to get involved. And I can't tell you any more about it right now because it hasn't actually happened yet. But she was really excited about it. And I was excited for her and also to learn that private equity was interested in businesses like that. Service business, started as a family business, growing, terrific reputation, and they want to come in and put money in it and allow this person to have less day-to-day responsibilities for the business, which is really nice. It's a great way out, and I think we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah. Is it, some people almost feel like that's sort of a dirty word. Is it, you know, what is your experience in working with these firms, and should people be a little more open to what they might offer?
I think that there's usually more money.
Yeah.
But them, I mean, they don't have, usually it can often be a cash deal. They don't really need to finance typically.
Gotcha.
So that's an advantage. I think, and I'll share from my own experience, that you, your business isn't going to run exactly the same way after you don't have total control of it. And sometimes that's really hard to take, both yourself, your employees, and your customers, your clients, because it is different. But you have to, you would hope that the business making the investment is going to run it properly.
Yeah.
Because why would they make an investment if they didn't want to do that?
Right.
But you have to be ready for change and for things to work differently. I've seen situations where people were really nervous day one, and the acquiring company came in and said, "Oh, we're not going to make any changes." And I say to people, "Don't say that because it's not true. It can't be true. You're going to make changes because that's just the right thing to do."
Right.
You have to manage them and hopefully do them incrementally, but you're going to make changes. And I think it's important to set the expectations up front.
Yeah, and I think that's we're talking about private equity, but that really is the situation with any, whether it's a sale or investor that joins your company,
more any kind of acquisition.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can't be that in control if you want to pass the torch, right?
Exactly. And that's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So talking about all the things that you've got new apartment deals coming up. And, I think that probably one of the reasons that these apartment deals are so hot is because we got so many people coming to the area, right? Because of these big manufacturing investments. Can you talk a little bit about some of the cool things that are happening in the region that are drawing these folks?
Certainly. I mean, I think top of the headlines this week was a company called Onsemi, which is a semiconductor company moving to East Syracuse, just outside of Syracuse. They're hoping to bring about 90 employees, and they're moving into a building that has been vacant for a while.
Wow.
So that's really nice to see the stock being used.
Yeah.
They seem really excited to become part of our tech community, and it's growing like crazy. So that I think that's a very big positive thing. We don't want to depend upon just one company for growth.
Absolutely.
And it's nice to see the companies that are there. 90 employees is a lot. That's a huge influence on our economy. And they're a Fortune 500 international company, which, again, we were losing those up until the last few years.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see them come back.
100%.
Yes.
And that adds to that whole high tech and the chips world. But they do some unique things with different type of devices and things I was reading about. They're going to be a neat company to have in town.
Right. And that's fun, too.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that attracts younger people.
Right.
And I think that's very important for our employment base.
100%. For years, we've had this incredible education system where we, educate the brightest and then we send them away.
Yes.
Okay. Let's keep them here.
Or at least bring them back.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely. There's some other things going on in our state around technology and labor and things like that. What are you seeing in your world around those lines?
I saw a very cool company that is working in Rochester right now. And instead of doing traditional window cleaning with people hanging off the sides of your buildings, they're using drones.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, boy, that's really cool. Talk about an old school business that's upgraded their technology. They're struggling a little bit with the Department of Labor because they don't know how to handle it.
I see.
There's a lot of rules about cleaning big buildings, which there should be from a safety point of view. So they're working with the Labor Department now, with the state, to get certified in a different way that no one's ever certified a company like
wow.
that before. So I really love seeing new vendor types in the construction and building industry.
Yeah.
And I flagged that company because I just thought that's really interesting.
Absolutely.
To do something different, thinking ahead. And boy, it's a lot safer.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw, just very recently, there was in New York City, a window cleaner got stuck and one of the cables broke and the thing was swinging around and breaking windows and stuff.
It was yes.
a scary situation.
It can hurt people in a lot more directions than you think it can.
Yeah. Interesting thing. The most common comment that you saw on those news stories was, hasn't somebody come up with a better way at this point to do that?
Right. And they haven't.
There
I mean,
you go. It's
people have been
drones.
Cleaning windows the same way for decades and decades.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the squeegees got a little better, but, you know, it's still water and people.
Right.
You know, and I think those are the kind of jobs that are amongst the hardest to fill, too. So if you can use technology for that and then let people do the other jobs that you can't use technology for.
Completely agree. No, that's incredible. So, you know, as you're looking at these different things, we teased a little bit at the beginning about due diligence. So let's dig into this a little bit. So tell me if I'm wrong. You do a deal, and by a deal, we'll say, I see this cool building that I want to buy and it's got a business in it. It's all ready to go. All one package. It sounds like a great deal. I don't just walk up and like negotiate the cash in my pocket and that's over. I should, there's more to it. You're telling me?
Absolutely.
This is news to me. So
yes.
Tell me a little bit about this due diligence step.
So due diligence is a very important part of the deal. What you want to do is make sure that you know all the facts, make sure that what you were told up front, when you first started looking at the deal is true. Make sure that you're comfortable with it. It's kind of a breathing space too. So when you sign a contract, typically there'd be a due diligence period. It might be 30 to 60 days, depending upon the size of the deal. And then you will start, and hopefully immediately, because time goes by really fast.
Sure.
And you'll say, all right, there's a business in there. I'd like to see what they're paying. I'd like to see their lease so that I can back up what they're paying. I'd like to see their payment schedule. Are they paying on time?
Mm-hmm.
Are they struggling? You know, because these are all things their bank's going to want to know
too. Sure.
And then you want to look at the physical. You know, so the financials are very important, of course. That's usually the first thing people do. And it's typically the easiest because if you're working with a good seller or a good management company, they're going to give you those numbers.
They got that ready to go usually.
Yes. And if it was my listing, I would encourage people to have those ready in advance because I'm going to use that for valuation also.
Sure.
And then you want to do physical due diligence. You want to look at the building. You want to look at the roof. You want to look at the yard. Are there any environmental concerns? You know, was it a gas station? Was it an old factory that might have oil on the floors?
I see.
And typically in apartment complexes, it's not generally a problem because you're not doing that sort of work. But in other types of buildings, it can be a problem. You want to make sure that, you know, they'll come in due diligence and check for radon, for example.
I see.
And we don't often think about that. We hear a lot about carbon monoxide but radon with some of the rocks that we have around here is important.
Yeah.
So you want to do your physical due diligence. You want to do your financial due diligence. And then I like to say, and then title, and your attorney will do that for you typically.
Uh-huh.
Usually in any deal, there'll be a contingency that says if the seller cannot provide clear title, then this deal can be canceled at any time. That's very important. You want to know that you have clean title. There aren't any liens against the property.
Yeah.
And usually people pretty much know that up front. The sellers know that up front. But you get a surprise every so often.
Yeah.
Right. And then something that's not written into the contracts, but I like to advise my buyers, is find out how happy your tenants are. Mm. I had a deal in downtown Syracuse, large office building, beautiful building. Went through all of our regular due diligence. I was representing the seller. The buyer never asked how happy are the tenants. And within a year, his building was half empty after he bought it. Because there were some tenants that they were just a lot because of the structure of their businesses needed to move. Or perhaps they had head issues. And so I think it's very important to, if you can, as much as possible, because you do try to be discreet and not let everybody in the world know that you're either selling or buying the building. But I think it's important as part of due diligence to make sure that what's happening today is going to continue to happen as much as you can.
Yeah.
You know, business is a risk. And you know, entrepreneurs, that's definition of an entrepreneur is they take a risk, right? But I think you can minimize your risks as much as possible.
That's very good advice. Let me ask you, you mentioned a little bit there about information the bank might want if this is a bank finance deal. Was your due diligence the same things that a bank might do? And would you turn over basically your research to the bank to help them? Or is that two different worlds?
No, it's a lot of the same.
Okay.
So typically the buyer would turn it over to the bank because they're the customer. And then the bank will send an appraiser usually.
Gotcha.
And then the appraiser may ask for that information again, and they will compare it to other similar properties, see what it looks like. I just was on an appraisal inspection with an appraiser the other day, and it was for an apartment complex that's being bought to completely renovate. So you look at that a little differently. You know, you don't worry as much as about what is going on now because you know that in the budget is the renovation money.
Gotcha.
So it's important to know what the plans are for the building because you can communicate those. I wanted to make sure the appraiser wasn't going to ding the building because, you know, it had issues. We knew that going in and the price reflected it too.
Yeah.
So that's important. But the bank will probably request the majority of your due diligence. A lot of it will depend upon what your down payment is and your relationship with the bank and, sure. you know, your credit worthiness.
Will it help the terms of your loan or things like that if you have a better quality research done in advance sort of thing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
If there's a management company for the property, for example, and that management company has a good reputation, I worked with a management company for years who I knew that if I gave their numbers to a buyer, if there was an error, it would have been my mistake in transcribing something, to be honest, because they were that good.
Gotcha.
And that was hugely helpful to me because deals die in due diligence.
Sure.
And nobody wants that. It's not good for the buyer or the seller or the brokers involved.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. Christine, anything else on due diligence that folks should know or to look out for? And also is their agent, whether they're working with you, they're working with someone else, is that the person who should be advising, or are there other professionals you should be talking to at this stage as well?
You definitely want a good broker who is working with you and should obtain this information for you. They should want to do that. They should want to be involved in the deal. And then you'll have a team. You'll have your accountants involved, your attorneys. You may have sometimes people bring in inspectors to look at properties independently. I just did a physical site inspection on a property with an inspector that was hired by the bank. It's a team effort. Mm-hmm. And generally, not everyone knows everything.
Yeah.
You know, no one knows everything, I should say. And so it's important to look at it. It's a big investment for most people.
When you mention an inspector, is it the same type of person you'd use for a home inspection if I was buying a residential property?
I generally look for a commercial inspector.
So there are separate kind of specialty folks.
And there are people who do both too.
Gotcha.
And are good at both. If you're buying a 100-unit apartment complex, you don't really care if one burner doesn't work.
Yeah.
If you're buying a house, you might care about that.
Yeah.
Right. You want an inspector who's going to really look at a bigger picture. And, you know, the expensive items, the roofs, that sort of thing. And when I say expensive, it's relative, of course.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. This is incredible advice. And, you know, this is the reason that we're having these conversations. There's so many of these pieces, like we said, you got a lot of folks that are in a business. They start to get a position where they want to do some of these things. And, like, what are the steps and how you go about it is so fascinating but critical.
Yes.
In all of this. Well, I know we've got a guest that's going to join us in a few minutes, but before we do, I want to talk to you because I was scanning your website as I do so often, looking for cool things, and I see you got a couple of neat newer listings or a couple of listings you're working on. You've got one down in my old stomping grounds of Herkimer,
yes,
and one in our good buddy, our producer's homeland of Ithaca. So you're all over. Can you tell us just a little bit about these? Because they got a cool local connection for us here.
Oh, that's great. Yes. So the location in Herkimer is an office building. It's about 95% occupied. The tenants are Catholic Charities, who just signed a new lease last year.
Oh, wow.
And also the County of Herkimer, who have been there for three or four lease terms.
Wow.
So they continue to stay. They just signed a new lease last month, too.
Wow.
Or last year, I should say. This building has been owned by a family for many, many years. They're ready. They've been selling off their real estate, and they're really ready to get out now. Yeah,
you know, gotcha.
It's time. It's time.
Sure.
They want to spend more time with their grandchildren.
Yeah.
And it's a building that has some vacant space. There's a nice warehouse garage space with a small office that has upside potential. And there's also a full basement that, you know, with approval from Herkimer could be used. I like Herkimer because it's the county seat. Mm-hmm. There's Herkimer Community College. There's some pretty large retailers in the area. And it's just off the highway.
Yeah.
The Walmart there does huge amounts of money because they're sitting right at the foothills of the Adirondacks.
Sure.
So any business that, you know, would serve campers and hunters and, you know, anybody going, you know, hikers going to the Adirondacks, it's a great area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's pretty neat that you've, you're everywhere. Everywhere we go.
I'm a road warrior.
Even down in Ithaca.
Yes.
You got some land down there?
Is that yes.
What you got?
Two pieces of land. A lovely lady owns them. There's 95 acres in the town of Lansing, which is just north of the city of Ithaca.
Oh, wow.
I like this property a lot. It borders apartments, an industrial park, and a residential area.
Wow.
So you could buy the 95 acres and do three or four different things with it. I also like the town of Lansing because they're a little more landlord-friendly to their apartment owners.
I see.
So they don't have good cause eviction, which is an issue in the apartment business, which we'll talk about in another podcast.
Sure.
More. But there, I think it's a easier place to develop than within the city of Ithaca itself.
Wow.
Right. And the other piece of property is in the city of Ithaca. They'll be looking for housing, single-family housing, because that's what they prefer. It's only minutes from Cornell University, three different access points, and houses on one side that are probably $150,000 to $300,000 houses, and then on the other side probably $600,000 to $800,000 houses.
Oh, wow.
So you could build a different types of housing.
How big
is
that
attractive
piece?
That piece is 23 acres.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah. You got room for a couple nice houses.
Absolutely. More than that. Yes.
That's incredible.
Yes. So the lady who owns it has moved to Florida, and she's this is one of the last things in her portfolio in upstate New York.
Wow. That's pretty neat.
It is neat. I like it. I enjoy working in different cities, getting to know them and getting to know the marketplaces.
That's so incredible. Christine O'Connell Moore is the host with the most here, and she's about to be joined by an incredible guest. So we will take a break, and we will come back with that guest, and stick around.
Thank you, Matt. Good afternoon, Jamie. It's my pleasure to introduce Jamie Michelle Kane, an attorney from Buffalo, New York, who specializes in we got go Bills, right? Yay! Who specializes in commercial real estate transactions as well as other business transactions. And I'd like to turn it over to Jamie to talk a little bit about herself, what she does, and her background, maybe.
Thank you, Christine. I was honored to be one of your first guests on the new podcast. So I know you're off to an amazing start. Let's keep it going today. So I'm Jamie Michelle Kane. I am a senior partner at Lipsitz Green Shimei Cambria in Buffalo. As Christine mentioned, I have been a real estate attorney since the inception of when I started practicing, now over 20 years of law. I went to school at Syracuse undergrad and for law school. My parents are both SU alumni, so go Orange, which is where Christine and I really connected first in some of the meetings that I would attend in Syracuse. Originally, I got my start working at another firm in Rochester, and most of my beginning part of my career was in Rochester. I worked there for over a decade and got my feet wet in landlord-tenant law, and that led to me wanting to specialize in commercial real estate transactions. I do have a craft specialty in the multifamily area, I'm a staunch advocate for the housing industry, whether that's lobbying, championing, both on the landlord as well as the tenant side. And I find that makes me somewhat of a unique individual because I do have experience seeing it from both perspectives. It has also enabled me to dive deeper, I think, into negotiations for things like commercial strip malls and hotels and other avenues that I now dabble in because of the strong background that I had from a formations or, if you will, concierge type service. So I do all things soup to nuts when it relates to the multifamily industry, whether that's the negotiation of leases, contracts, refinances, acquisitions. I do a ton of eviction work. And that's something that, even though it's kind of the lower level type work people think of, it's very important to maintain for our clients, especially those landlords that we represent that don't really get much understanding sometimes and need advocacy for the efforts to maintain their rent rolls.
Thank you, Jamie. And I know we share some common clients.
Yes.
And over the years, many transactions. And it's really important to have a good team. And I love working with an attorney who will work with brokers and realize that there's a team.
100%. I think the foundation of a client base, especially as a woman in this industry, it is to work with people, collaborate, follow up, thank them when they give you referrals, always try and give those referrals back, and really see the industry as a team framework. We're all kind of in this together. We're all customers or referrals or advocates for each other. And really that makes the housing industry grow.
Oh, and anything you can do to help that, especially today, we need so much new housing in upstate New York.
Definitely.
So we've been talking about due diligence earlier in the podcast, and I'd love to get your perspective on it as an attorney. Could you share with us what you recommend to your clients for the due diligence period?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, a strong purchase and sale contract that negotiates what a due diligence time period is and defining it in terms of what's allowed, what's not allowed, and basics, right? So things like, when does that due diligence period start and when does it end? A lot of the times we are now doing deals with people that are not, you know, in the same town or in the same zip code as you. And so sometimes it's critical just to know where your buyer and seller are, because a due diligence time period may expire 5 p.m., but is it 5 p.m. Eastern time or is it 5 p.m. Mountain time? So those critical details are, you know, an attorney's really got to hone in and know to put in a contract for no issues that come up later when you're trying to have any arbitrary or details that can be negotiated to mean two different things. So that's really important. But as it relates to the due diligence specifically, it is an opportunity to analyze and inspect the physical as well as the financial condition of a property before committing to purchase that property. And typically this is done at the sole discretion of the buyer so that the buyer has an opportunity to review the property, see if it meets the buyer's intended purpose and the way in which they want to own that property. And that gives them a sort of a free look, but it's also a buyer beware look, right? Because depending on the terms of what you've negotiated, there could be sellers, reps and warranties that the seller's willing to give you depending on how much information they're giving you up front. Or you could be dealing with an as-is contract where the seller's really not going to rep much. And it's critical then that you do your homework on that property because you're purchasing it subject to your own discoveries that you're going to make along that process.
It's interesting that you mentioned that that people are not always in upstate New York when you're dealing with them. Yesterday, I was talking to a gentleman from another country, and we had a discussion about what money are we, whose money are we talking about? And we made an agreement that we would always talk in U.S. dollars because it's a property in the U.S. But I think you could have a lot of misunderstandings if you didn't clarify that up front.
100%. There's been times where due diligence expires at 5 p.m. And like I said, it's a situation where somebody's in Dallas and we're thinking it's New York time and we don't have, the sign off on due diligence. And so we're canceling a contract and their understanding is, no, it's, 2 hours to go. And, that really needs to be flushed out of is it on this time period or is it on that time period? And if you don't have a meeting of minds up front, you're going to run into problems.
And we all know that how crucial those last 2 hours can be, right?
So, I mean, sometimes a deal really can bend on what, especially when we're dealing with contracts that sometimes have built-in deposit extensions, where if you don't exercise something, you don't get the right to do something. So it really, you know, those basics are could sometimes be millions of dollars on the line.
Absolutely. Can you share with us some of the times where you've seen where really good due diligence processes have helped a buyer or a seller?
Sure. So from the buyer side, I'll kind of break it down into buyer and then seller. From the buyer side, I have seen deals where if you're not getting your hands on what's the vesting deed, so the deed into the seller, you can't confirm, number one, that the seller is even the owner. And I've seen deals actually turn on that issue where you're not even dealing with somebody who has the authority to sell the property. So I think it's critical in that initial stages to see the corporate formation documents, to know the seller has authority to sell, as well as that vesting deed. So that's kind of first and foremost what we tend to look at. And these are things that I think make it so important to know and deal and work with an attorney as well as a broker who's well-versed in due diligence. If you're dealing sometimes with an attorney on the other side, kind of dabbles in real estate, there may be things that get overlooked here. So, you know, we're also looking at things like the physical structure. So defects, latent issues that you may not be able to just see if you're looking at the building, you need to kind of dive a little bit deeper. But sometimes what I've gotten involved with as clients is their budget, and you really become a counselor for them of, okay, you're going in, you're doing this due diligence, but then maybe you discover that the roof that you thought based on a property disclosure was new actually has an issue. And so it's more sometimes about that financial of, hey, what's your CapEx budget going to look like? Do you have enough money to do these repairs to maintain this building now that you've seen the issues? So sometimes it's counseling clients as to, you know, the way in which maybe we have to go back to the seller at that point and say, something's not represented correctly. We need to lower the price of the property, or we need to do something where you guarantee some things are fixed prior to us closing.
So Jamie, what kind of prior uses might be a concern when doing environmental inspections?
So there are some that have historic uses that would potentially have toxins or any kind of fumes that might have seeped either into the water or the soil. So specifically when dealing with manufacturing or any industrial types of properties, gas stations specifically, anything having to deal with oils. Those are the properties that we would be very careful about recommending additional either surveying or use of like technology. Sometimes you can use some type of surface equipment to see if there is metal in the ground or subsurface. All of that is going to be prudent to make sure that the prior use is vetted. We specifically had a situation where there was a prior industrial building and they were concerned with adhesives, inks, machinery oils, protective coatings, otherwise known as PFAs. The concern was that during the use of the building, which had been in use from prior to 1950, there was no environmental regulation until the 1970s or early 80s. And so they would dispose of these toxins or potentially equipment uses without regulations. And so vetting that and making sure it hasn't seeped into the soil, hasn't seeped into the water is very prudent, whether you're a buyer or a seller, to know what you're dealing with as you are in chain of title and potentially have cleanup responsibilities to those findings.
Thank you. Could you take a minute to explain the difference between phase one and phase two for those that might not know?
Sure. So phase one is going to be typically recommended. Sometimes you'll get just kind of usually the seller, let's jump back for a second. Usually the seller, what they do is do like a property disclosure statement. And when there's a lender involved, the lender will typically give them a form for them to screen the property on paper. So they take a look at the paper, they fill out all of the potential issues that would be there. And sometimes a phase one is recommended. And a phase one, most oftentimes when any lender is involved, this is what happens. And it's going to be a situation where you're looking at the records, you're looking at the historical uses, and you're not doing anything really on the property, but you're just kind of records keeping to see, was there any spills? Were there any contaminations? What's the historical uses? Are there any potential based on those uses for there to be environmental toxins or concerns? If that comes back with a potential for a situation, then a phase two would be recommended. And a phase two is going to be specifically something where you are going and doing tests on the property. So you're either going to be looking at the water, soil. Sometimes, you know, it is going and doing some form of surveying with electrical equipment to see if there are any USTs or underground subsurface tanks. So again, it's truly dependent on the prior use usually, or if there's some indication of a prior cleanup or something that's necessary. And a phase one typically going to run you under $2,000 or so, where a phase two can be anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000. And then the cleanup efforts of which could be, you know, sometimes in the hundreds of thousands, depending on what the problem is.
Thank you. One of the struggles I see sometimes in a deal is a buyer will do a letter of intent, which is non-binding and informal, but it gives the terms of the deal typically. And then we go to a contract, and all of a sudden due diligence becomes a struggle. I'm curious as to your opinion regarding letters of intent versus contracts.
Sure. So they're definitely used. They're not always used. There is some concerns there. I think there's good and bad. So the pros being that it is a roadmap for the transaction. Most of the time, the critical meeting of the minds of the material terms are going to be done. So your price, your time frame, those are going to all be laid out. The cut to the chase element of a letter of intent is really good, because you're going to upfront know what are the major issues, what do we need to go negotiate to get this deal to get off the ground. So in that, you know, part of it, it's really helpful. It can build rapport between the parties. It can certainly make it so that you're establishing trust, because you're kind of going back and forth with this negotiation and trying to work out the kinks ahead of time. To your point, most of the time it is non-binding. It's going to make sure that that you're just putting it forward. However, there has been case law, and one of the cons of using these is, if there is a clear and unambiguous understanding of the parties, if all the material terms can be gleaned from those four corners of the document, you could run into a situation where the actual letter of intent becomes binding. And that is something to be concerned of. So as an attorney, whenever my clients are trying to entertain this, we always say, okay, be careful. You want to be explicit about the parts that are not binding from those that are binding. And sometimes we do recommend that there is a separate NDA or confidentiality agreement, so that that document can be interpreted on its own, so that there can be no ambiguity of the confidentiality part. Because sometimes in this process, you're dealing with people where you're selling a business, and you can't, you know, you don't want to spill the tea on I'm selling the business. Your employees are going to get upset. You don't want it to make media attention of those things. So you want to avoid contract terms like it's agreed upon, or upon acceptance, or disagreement, or the party shall. All of those are kind of trigger words that can make a letter of intent binding. And the binding agreement part, you want to specify that this will be memorialized in a separate agreement to be negotiated after this letter of intent. You want words like that so that you don't trigger the binding nature of it. I do think, though, that it helps prepare the PSA. Certainly, if you're having trouble reaching agreements in that, you know, phase, when you get to the point where you are in due diligence, that's going to be a problem. I do think that from a reputation standpoint, if you are going to negotiate a letter of intent, you're going to set certain expectations and agreements. And then you go in the PSA and you try and undo those paragraphs. And I see all kinds of redlining in the PSA that I get when I draft it with the intent of the letter of intent. I think that's somewhat disingenuous. I think you do potentially risk your reputation of, well, you just wasted all my time going through this letter of intent, which is intended to save money. And now look what we're doing. So I do think that kind of leaves a sour taste when that happens.
I agree with you. And certainly we've seen cases where in the letter of intent, they'll say, we're going to close June 1st. And then all of a sudden the contract comes along and it's September 1st. And where did that come from?
Right. 100%.
So it's those sort of things. Yes.
Yeah. And then sometimes you're like, okay, well, if you were going to negotiate an extra 3 months, then I would have put in extension deposits or in extension times because, you know, the further out from, I think that's a good point, a due diligence in general. What's the expected time of a due diligence period, right? Most of the time in commercial transactions, we're seeing, I don't know, 45 to 60 days as your average. But sometimes we've had deals where there are 120 days to start. And my radar kind of goes off like, why do you need 120 days? And a lot of that revolves around financing. And certainly in the last couple of years, it's been tough. And we've had deals where we enter into contracts, letter of intent, then PSAs with an expectation that this is going to be a fairly quick close. And then financing takes forever. And so in the letter of intent process, if I'm asking the right questions, I'm trying to figure out how are they going to buy this? And if there's a potential that they are not going to have financing be coterminous with the inspection period, as I like to see, I am going to put in some additional measurements of reassurance for my seller that, hey, this buyer is somebody who's going to be able to purchase the property because we're going to put in $50,000 extension deposits for every month we have to go through due diligence rather than just let them have 120 days up front. I want assurances that they're still continuing to do something versus waiting 120 days to find out they're going to kill the deal.
Well, I think that definitely separates the good buyers from the bad buyers, and it makes them real. And I'm sure you would agree that time kills deals.
Time definitely kills deals, especially when there's, you know, not many properties for a while that were on the market, or there's specialty properties that, you know, they come up and there's going to be a flood of potential buyers because that's a hot property for what that purpose is. And you don't want to waste somebody's time when then somebody might go grab something else and you lose out on an actual buyer. So I do think, depending on what your side you're on, if you're a seller, you want time of the essence to close that deal quickly. You also want the least amount of reps and warranties that you're going to give somebody. So these are all things that it's not just purchase price. It's really the nit and grit of how the deal is going to flow, which to your point, the LOI can really give you an indication. And that's the usefulness of trying to figure that out. Is this the right buyer? Or maybe we should, you know, cut our losses now and not go further down this road, because even though, you know, they're somebody who wants to entertain the purchase, they might not be the right buyer to actually get us through the process to close.
Absolutely. And that's the details in the deal, without question.
100%. Yes.
Right. So we're just about out of time, but I wanted to give you an opportunity. I know that you do a lot of landlord-tenant work, and you and I have worked together on some things, but April is Fair Housing Month. And I know you're doing a real estate roundtable. If you want to take a minute to talk about that.
Yes. So I host a monthly real estate roundtable. We do it in person in Buffalo, but everything is filmed. So it is something that anyone anywhere else can jump in and watch after the fact. We are also hoping to bring those back to Rochester soon. So it might be a little closer for other people. But April marks Fair Housing Month. And so we are going to be doing a roundtable on April 24th. From 9 to 11, it is held at the Buffalo Club in downtown Buffalo. For anyone who is interested in attending, it is free. It is basically going to be a cursory review of the 2024 cases and what to look out for so that you don't go to what I call fair housing jail.
Great. Thank you. I've attended many of your real estate roundtables, and always worth the trip to Buffalo if you can do it. And good people to network with, too.
Yes. I think that's the value I hope people get out of it.
I agree. Great. Jamie, we're going to put your contact information up after we're done talking. And I'm going to definitely have you back to talk more about fair housing and also tenant-landlord laws and things happening in New York State with real estate.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me again. And congratulations on the podcast. I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Jamie.
Okay. Take care.
Well, this is the end of our podcast, but I just wanted to share with you that we are going to have a guest each month. Future guests are going to include bankers that specialize in commercial real estate. I especially have a banker I'm really looking forward to having join us who is new to the marketplace from downstate New York, and he really liked what he saw is happening in upstate New York. So I'm hoping if he can't come on next month, we'll have him on the following month to talk about why his bank chose to finance a deal that was a little bit difficult to finance. We're also going to have a representative from the Apartments Professional Trade Society of New York to talk about what the society does for landlords and tenants in the area, as well as investors who are going to talk about partnerships and joint ventures. And I have a really interesting commercial insurance agent who's going to come on later in the year, and she's going to talk about proper insurance for properties and also really what you need to look for when you're choosing insurance. And I'd love to hear back from the people who are listening to our podcast to hear what it is that you'd like to hear. Talk to you next month. Thank you.